Here it comes, the latest people, trends, and news on sustainable living in and around our corner of the country. Down to Earth with Mrs. Green, Spotlight on the Southwest. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are listening to Down to Earth with Mrs. Green. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and we are glad you're here. Spotlight on Tucson water reliability for this show, Water Quality. This is the third of a six-part series we're doing with the Water Department to talk about our most precious resource, something that it seems like every conversation when you're out to dinner, somehow water comes up in one way, shape, or form, and maybe it's because I bring it up. You never know, because now I'm a semi-expert after these shows. And to help showcase many of the outstanding water conservation efforts and other important programs that really do reflect this department's outstanding leadership, their thought leadership, their passion, and their commitment to offer distinguished water-saving programs that benefit our community and our planet, not just now, but they have planned for our future. So I am thrilled to have with me in studio for the next 30 minutes, Fernando Molina. Fernando, it's great to have you here, public information officer and knower of all things as it relates to Tucson Water. I haven't stumped you yet. And Ramey Sawyer, an environmental scientist from Tucson Water, City of Tucson. Again, thanks so much to both of you for being here today.
Glad to be here.
I'm glad you're here too. It is an issue. We talked a little bit off air. People want to know about water. It's much easier for them to get their head around it. It's top of mind because of things like Flint, Michigan. It's top of mind because it's so hot out and we're instituting water saving things for this summer. Give us an overview again, Fernando, of the whole concept of water reliability.
Well, you know, you mentioned at the introduction the wonderful water conservation programs that we offer, and that's what people normally call me up and ask me to come and talk to them about. But over time, when I would talk to them about our water conservation programs, what we offer, why we do these things, I would open the floor up to questions, and the questions were about everything else. And so I thought, well, maybe, and there is a connection.
Yes.
And so that's where the idea of water reliability was born, was from the questions that people had. And so just to remind your listeners that water reliability, we've established five elements that we feel are the core concepts of water reliability. Those are water supply, water quality, customer service, that's a very critical part. We have water operations or infrastructure, and we also have efficiency programs, which is water conservation and how we use water and how we manage water. And so they're all connected. So any difference that you can make, say, in reducing demands can have an impact on our water operations. It can have an impact on water quality. It can have a long-term impact on our water supplies. So they're all connected. And today what we're going to focus on is water quality. And so that's a very critical part because, as I tell people, we can spend a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of money developing a water supply. But if it doesn't meet the quality standards for whatever that use is, it really is no good. I mean, so we make a strong effort to ensure that, and this is a critical part of water quality and developing water supplies. The water supply has to, the quality has to match the water supply needs. And so I use the example often of, a little over 30 years ago, Tucson Water developed a new water supply. It was our reclaimed water system. So knowing that it was just going to be for irrigation purposes, it did not need to meet drinking water standards. However, there are standards for reclaimed water that needed to be met. And so as we move forward, whether it's a non-potable use of water or a drinking water effort to develop a new supply, water quality is always first and foremost up front as we move forward with that.
And what really matters to me is that in this evolution of these shows and my learning curve and being out there, and people do ask me about things because of my persona of Mrs. Green, you are spot on. I started caring about making sure I had water and conserving it. But when we get down to it, it's like the quality really matters and what you do to get it to us and make sure it's safe matters, because it doesn't matter if there's a lot of supply, which is basically what you said, if the water's no good.
Yes, and I hope what your listeners learned today is that it's not just a matter of the quality of the water as we develop it as a supply, but keeping it at a high quality as it moves through the distribution system also very, very critical and a lot of work. And Ramey today will be able to address any questions that people might have with respect to that.
And so many moving parts. And I want to say this now, and I hope I remember to say it at the end of the show. People are going to learn a lot in this show. We're going to get on to real content-rich stuff that I talk about that you'll share with us. Share it with a friend. Listen to the podcast. Say, wow, I didn't know that. Send the link out to 5 people so that they can be up to date on what's going on with the water quality as well and water reliability. So let's talk about monitoring water quality at the source and throughout the distribution system. There are lots of moving parts in this. So talk about that, Ramey.
Okay. Well, we are regulated under the Department of Environmental Quality, and EPA has standards, and they specify standards that we have to monitor for. So right now we have about 90 standards that we keep a track of. And there's about 200 drinking water wells that supply water to the city, and there's a set frequency and there's certain limits that are acceptable. And so we have in our distribution system points as well that we take samples from, and there's about 266 sample points that we monitor for. And so our laboratory goes out and they collect the samples, and they analyze the samples, and then we review the results and compare it to the standards to make sure that it meets those standards. And if they don't meet those standards, there are many, depending on the situation, many actions that we will take.
Then you go into the intervention mode.
Right, right.
But what are things, so they're the source or the wells?
Right.
And then there are so many, like I just have this vision of so many pipes bringing the water into homes and businesses and
right.
and lawns and all of that.
Right.
So there are different monitoring points along the water distribution route?
Right, right.
Okay.
Certain wells feed certain parts of town.
Right.
And then within that section, there are monitoring sites that we would sample to determine water quality.
Got it. Mm-hmm. And do you have what's the frequency? That's the question I had. How often do you monitor the quality of the water?
Okay. It depends on the actual regulations. The majority of them right now are quarterly, but for bacteria, for coliform, we test it every month. So that would be the most frequent. But if we have issues in the system, we'll do it at our discretion and do it even more frequent than what the regulations require.
And, you know, I was cracking up when I was preparing to this show. I said, oh, they made a mistake. They said coliform. It must be chloroform.
Oh, no.
Well, it is indeed coliform. Mm-hmm. Tell us what that is and why you have to monitor it so strictly.
Oh, okay. Well, it's a bacteria that's generally found in the atmosphere. And what we're really looking for is, it's an indicator of what we're really looking for, which is fecal contamination, because E. coli comes from the gut of mammals and people. And so what that indicates to us is that there's fecal contamination that's a pathway into our distribution system. And with that, there might be other pathogens that are associated with fecal matter. So it's very important. And people that have immunocompromised systems may
be very dangerous for them.
For them, right.
Got it.
Right.
Got
so
it.
That's why we test for it frequently, and it's a big deal if we find it in our system.
And then what happens if you do? What goes into place? What's the telephone tree to that situation when
right.
you find out? We got a problem.
Right. Well, we have procedures in place. So basically the laboratory lets us know, and we notify ADEQ, our regulators, within 24 hours. And then our operations superintendent requests flushing, and we look at the chlorine because the disinfection will kill the bacteria. So we flush it to get more new water into the system. And then we let our regulators know. And then within 24 hours, we have to go back out there and make sure that it is fixed.
And do you have to notify consumers, or it just depend on how serious, if it's like a little bit, you know,
yeah.
this is a high standard, nobody's going to get hurt, or are there times when you would have to notify someone that might have had a nice big cold drink of water?
It depends on what our results are, but if we get E. coli and then within 24 hours we get either total coliform or E. coli again, that's the regulations consider that a tier one violation, and we have to give notice within 24 hours to our customers that were affected. And we don't want to shut the entire city down, so we have
Thank
water
you.
Service
That's
areas.
Good. That's good to know.
Right? So we have water service areas, and so we would just target that. And we have procedures in place where we would send the letters out within 24 hours. They actually have like 42,000 pre-printed envelopes at their warehouse just so that it's ready to go, because that would be our biggest water service area that serves 42,000 people. So we have that there. And then we would, of course, contact public information.
That's where the public information office comes in, because we would then be responsible for assisting with the mail notifications of all those letters. There are often very specific requirements of who you have to notify: health facilities, daycare facilities, public centers, things like that. So the notification process is pretty rigorous in terms of detecting something and verifying that you have that. I think Remy didn't really get into the detail of how much work it takes to determine the source. Because
honestly,
we have to go back
needle
and
in
we
a
have to start looking to see where
beyond.
The water comes from for delivery to the zone. And then we have to figure out which wells they are. So there's a lot of work that goes behind that. And in the meantime, we're providing the public notification.
Right.
We're fortunate because it's been quite a while since we've had any of this kind of situation. And the last time it occurred was in an area southwest of Tucson in the Three Points area. We operate a small, what we call an isolated service area, where it has one or two wells that provide water service for that area there. And it worked. I mean, we did the notifications. Fortunately, it was just a small contained area, so we were able to, I think we were out knocking on doors and hand-delivering notifications
out. Right, not out highly there. Populated.
And
right.
Again, having to go back, that's just the public notification side of it. On the technical side of things, we had to do some investigations and try and figure out the source.
Right, and I wanted to add that we actually provided water to the
yes.
customers. So we set up a water tank so that they could have an alternative source.
And it's very comforting to know that it's so highly monitored and there has hardly been anything ever. That's
right.
That's something that I think consumer confidence is huge, and I'm always happy. So anyway, do you have things like, I would call them fire drills, but they're not. Do you have staff training on incident reporting? And since it's so rare that it happens, how do you make sure staff are on board to know what to do if there is an incident? It does matter.
Okay. I'm sure Fernando could add to this. But when rules change, we have to update our internal procedures. And so just recently, actually.
Redo the manual.
Right. We have flow charts. And I did some classes for internally for Tucson Water staff, because more than one section is going to be involved. We've got the maintenance. We've got operations. We've got
so
public
many
information.
Moving parts.
So many, right? So we offered, and they got credit, a class on just this, the emergency notification procedures. So we have procedures internally, and we do the training.
And Remy has done an excellent job putting together the manual so that everybody understands what their role is in responding to a situation like this. In addition to the training, we do periodically conduct what we refer to as tabletop exercises. So we actually engage critical staff in responding to an event. We set up
That's the fire drill I was talking about.
It's a mock situation, and we set up an emergency command center, and we start getting information in terms of what it is we're responding to, and we react, and we undertake our emergency response plan. And that's the first 4 or 5 days of responding to any critical situation.
Right, right.
In this case, it could be that we're testing our response for some sort of contamination situation.
Right, right.
And we actually have close calls, too, that kind of, it's not a violation in itself, but we may find just total coliform, which is not the dangerous kind, but the same procedures would be implemented. And so last year, we've had about 5 situations like that. So there is practice with the real thing as yes. well.
I keep thinking of all these terms like big water is watching instead of big brother. And that's important. I want to know all these things to me. I told you guys off air that as a consumer, my confidence in details and the depth and breadth of the things you're doing has been really impressive, which is why I'm going to encourage listeners to share this podcast and the other ones that we have. So you have your own certified lab in-house?
Yes.
And then what would happen? Would it ever happen that you had to go outside and use another lab? And can you give me an example of why?
Well, there are, as I mentioned, about 90 drinking water regulated contaminants, right?
Like, what?
Yes. And there are some that may not be developed yet in our laboratory, and it's just easier, for example, to have a different laboratory analyze it for us. And one of them would be we test for radiochemistries, radionuclides. So we send those out to Nevada. Not a lot of laboratories are certified for that. By the way, our laboratory is certified by the Department of Health Services. So, so it's a very specialized field. So in those areas, we would send our samples out to them.
Got it. Now, let's talk about Flint, Michigan. In some ways, sadly, it really has put in the front and center of national spotlight what can happen if you have a compromised water supply. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so horrific, it's hard to even talk about. Has anything like that ever happened, close to that happened in Tucson?
We actually experienced exactly what happened at Flint, Michigan with respect to the water sources.
Changing.
And this was in the early 90s.
Okay.
This is when our first attempt to convert from groundwater to Colorado River water. It was the exact same thing that happened in Flint. Water chemistry was slightly different. The surface water that we introduced into the distribution system was a little more corrosive than the native groundwater that we had been pumping and pushing through our pipes. Well, when you look at what was happening in Flint, a lot of the same things were there. Red water and brown water. So
the water
just got really dirty.
They'd show it on TV what happened when the faucets went on.
That's exactly what happened here. The good news is we've undertaken a pretty significant effort already to remove any lead from our distribution system. And so that's why the lead was not a problem. That tends to be a problem in older cities that were developed many, many, long before Tucson was. The only areas that we actually, as we went and reviewed this, the only areas of town that did have lead were the older parts of town, around downtown, areas that were developed early 1900s, 1920s, around in there. I think Ramey can address what our procedures are today to continue to address that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. So how do you pick sample points for lead monitoring?
We're actually in the middle of updating ours. Well, the regulations require us to pick homes that were built between 1982 and 1988 because...
Interesting.
It was before the lead ban that EPA banned in 1988. So just that they may have lead solder in their plumbing. So we would collect at the worst case scenario at those homes. So those are what we targeted. So we look at when the homes were built.
Right.
And we get a list for each system, and we call them and see if they'd be interested in being a part of our monitoring plan. And basically, we would drop off a bottle and they would collect a sample after it's been sitting there for 6 hours unused. And then they'd call the lab, would pick it up, and we would analyze the samples free of charge. And then we would give them the results by mail and report them to DEQ. And we don't anticipate any problems at all, but it's just part of the monitoring that we're required to do just to ensure that everything's okay.
Really watching for it. And I actually read in my prep that there's LCR webpage.
Oh, there is.
So what is that?
Oh, right. With everything that happened in Flint, Michigan, EPA has requested through the Department of Environmental Quality to request all systems, especially large water systems like Tucson Water, to be forthcoming with their monitoring, their results, any problems.
Transparency.
That's exactly.
Great word. Transparency.
Yes. Exactly. That's what they use.
Yes.
Yeah. So with that in mind, we put our monitoring plan on our Tucson Water webpage for everyone to take a look. And it's interesting. It identifies potential sources of lead, what you can do, like flushing for a minute before actually, you know, drinking the water, and then where potential lead service lines may exist. We've had an aggressive policy to remove lead lines on the public side.
Got it.
So we have all that information on a webpage.
Mm-hmm. So our standard practice today is if we're working, again, primarily this is the older parts of town, and we have crews working there, and they encounter what they believe is a lead service connection, we take that out, we remove it.
Right, and we've developed a procedure with DEQ where we would take a pre-removal lead sample, and then once it's been removed, then our maintenance crews lets us know, and then we would do a post-removal, and we'd give the results to the customer. And we've done it at two sites so far everything looked good. There mm-hmm. was no lead in the line. So we did develop that as a result of the Flint, Michigan.
You know, I sit here and
scenario.
Shake my head because it's just overwhelming to me in a very good way and insightful about how many moving parts. I just
yes.
can't, I cannot,
there really are.
I really cannot exaggerate that because you have to watch so much. And all we do on our end is drink the water.
Correct.
Right. That's my deal. And I take a shower, I brush my teeth, I flush the toilet, and I drink.
And what we've been discussing just now is really what we do after the water's in the system. But one of the things that we also have to do is monitor the pH levels in the water before it goes into the distribution system.
Right.
We did have an incident many, many years ago that was, again, this was an isolated system. It was its own groundwater well. It served
about
100 homes. Mm-hmm. We had some positive hits for lead there. And so the solution to that was the flushing, the cleaning, the notifications. But what we had to do with that particular well was implement a corrosion program.
Got it.
So that we could bring the pH down and...
Or up, sorry.
Or up, I can't remember.
Yeah, we want to make it more basic.
Chimes in the scientist.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes.
Keeps us all safe.
So
thanks, Raimi.
It's basically watching the pH and making sure. You know, when you're pumping water from groundwater wells, you can have a lot of variation in water quality. Fortunately,
based on where it is and all of that, yes.
And today, because most of our water supply is pumped out of the Avra Valley as part of the recharge and recovery of our renewable Colorado River water, we can actually observe it at the majority of the water at a single point. But every time we start turning on wells, because we still periodically operate our groundwater wells, that's one of the elements that we look at is what's the pH of the water.
Mm-hmm. And just adding on to that, in that system where we had the lead exceedance, is that we continue to monitor the pH every 2 weeks. And it has to be within a certain range. And if it's not within a certain range, we have to report to ADEQ.
These are just safeguards. It's like sleep tight, your water supply is safe. Mm-hmm. I want to ask this question, and I would never put you on the spot, but I wonder about this. I do. Do you have any concerns ever about water security? Or you know what I mean? Like contamination or anything? Is that a fair question to ask you, Fernando?
Yes, it is.
It's a really strange world
actually,
we live in.
We've been involved with studies through the University of Arizona to look at, number one, what would it take to really introduce some sort of contaminant into the distribution system? And you know, we're always concerned. We're always watching for this. We actually have protections in place to prevent introduction of contaminants through a business or a residence, intentional or unintentional, through our backflow device program. So these are valves. They're one-way valves, basically.
Got it.
They let water flow from our system into the business, and they don't let water flow backwards. So there's that element of protection that we have in our distribution system. You know, the other thing to remember is particularly when you're looking at things like biological agents, we chlorinate the water for a reason. And any kind of biological agent that might be introduced probably would not be very effective because of the chlorination that we include as part of our regular process.
And as the public information officer, and I'm kidding when I say Mr. Water, but I'm really not kidding. I mean, you have to know a lot to be able to answer questions. What are some consumer concerns? Like, I don't have any because I am doing these series of shows. And even before that, it's like I knew because of my relationship and being out in the community that our water is really high quality. We don't have to be worried. But what are consumers concerned about?
Well, you know, there's the general consumer sorts of issues that we get. And I would say that those are primarily hardness of water. So people notice that the taste changes with the hardness. You begin to see a lot of staining of appliances because it's mineralized water.
Water spots, we call them.
Water spots. Chlorine is another comment or call that we get. People are concerned about chlorine levels. And the other thing is what's often referred to as milky water. So this is not unusual. If you turn on your tap and the water comes out and it has kind of a milky appearance to it.
Yep.
Those are probably the three main things that we get calls about. There's no rhyme or reason as to which one is more frequently. It changes from time to time. More recently, when we switched over from our renewable water supply to our groundwater supply, in order for us to repair a large transmission main, we had to turn on several of our groundwater wells. Well, when you get the milky water, that's generally a result of air being sucked into the water as it's being pumped out of the ground or pumped through the system. And so the very simple way to check for whether that's what it is you can take a clear glass, fill it with water, and it should start clearing up from the bottom up. And what that is those little bubbles, essentially what you're seeing are little tiny air bubbles, will start to settle up towards the top.
So don't worry about
that. That should not be an issue.
Okay.
If it doesn't clear up, we need to know. And it's the same thing with chlorine. We like to have you should be able to detect a little odor of chlorine. But if it smells like a swimming pool, we need to know, because that means maybe some of our equipment has failed. And that's actually been the case where we have done. I remember working with a group of community health promoters, and one of the things we were teaching them was how we do the sampling. And we were at one of these individuals' homes. The chlorine levels were extremely high. And because we had done that test and because we were able to track it back to a chlorinator at one of the well sites miles and miles away, was just dosing it too high with chlorine, we were able to resolve that problem.
There was a glitch in the matrix.
There was a glitch in the system. We want to know when people are having problems. It doesn't matter whether it's a taste or an odor problem, if there's a pressure problem. We need to know these things.
Err on the side of caution, and you want those calls.
Because we need to be able to track these things down before it gets into a bigger problem.
Right. So a consumer who's listening is helping. You're helping to alert you and get feedback and let you know what's going to be going on. The most amazing thing to me in these interviews is that I look and there's 2 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
So I know we have to really talk about ways to get in touch with you before the show goes off. So because people do look. So tucsonaz.gov/water for the website. And then Facebook. It's a great source of information. The Facebook page, I have City of Tucson. Isn't there a water page? Yes, there is. There's a Twitter page. Your Twitter page is good. And it's twitter.com and it's Tucson Water. And also City of Tucson has another page, which is more generic. But the Twitter page that I think is that we use the most is tucsonwater.com.
Right. And for consumer issues, the sorts of things that I mentioned, if it tastes funny, it smells funny, it looks funny, or maybe the pressure's low, we also have a number that they can call. And that is 791-5945. And that's our, basically we have a SWAT team of technicians that respond to those kinds of issues. They can call that number, they can leave a message, they will be contacted. Oftentimes we can resolve these issues without sending anybody to the home. We can try and
talk it to them. 791-5945 is the number.
And could I just add that in case we ever had an emergency situation, we would post the information on our website.
Great. It's a good source of information.
Right.
Really and truly. You guys, this was great. And it's really such a service you're doing to the consumer in getting these words out. And more in-depth information, more than just sound bites. I mean, I appreciate it. And as I said, I'm out there wearing the adjunct staff member to the Tucson Water Department, which is really a scary thought. Everybody, our July 2nd show, it's the 6th anniversary of Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, me being independent network. And I'm having one of my first guests back, Greg Horn, who changed my life, wrote a book called Living Green, Make It a Great Green Week. Rami and Fernando, thank you so much for being here and
thanks
for what you do.
Thank you for having us.
It was great.
Thank you.